It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. This week, we've been highlighting great books we've read this summer and the authors behind them. Today, a personal story about the criminal justice system.
Even when they're quiet, jails have a distinct sound. Every whisper ricochets off the cinder block walls and heavy steel doors into a muffled cacophony, the echoing soundtrack of your mistakes in stereo.
This is Carrie Blakinger.
And I'm a reporter and the author of Corrections in Ink.
Corrections in Ink is Blakinger's memoir, and it's about the time she spent incarcerated in New York State.
Time melts, watches are banned, there is no clock. Sometimes there's a microwave that you can use to tell time, but sometimes the guards take that away. Maybe because you've pissed them off, or maybe because other inmates want it. So instead, sound becomes your sundial.
Growing up, Carrie was a rising star in competitive figure skating, but an eating disorder and drug addictions sent her down a different path.
The buzz clunk when the guards first pop the cell block door means it's 7 a.m. The rolling lunch carts mean it's noon. The crackle of the intercom announcing count means it's 3 p.m. Your day is metered out by the noises of incarceration, an inescapable score that restarts every day and plays on a seemingly endless loop. Even when they're quiet, jails have a distinct sound.
When Carrie was 26, she was arrested with a Tupperware full of heroin and sentenced to 2 years in prison. She spoke with me recently and talked about how time passes when you're doing time. What did you think imprisonment would be before you had the experience of being incarcerated?
Not sure I thought a lot about it. I mean, actually, I think I sort of distinctly didn't think a lot about it. I think when you're in an active addiction, you have to tell yourself that these things don't happen to you. Like, in order to keep taking these risks and doing such dangerous things, you have to tell yourself that statistics don't apply to you, that you're not going to, you know, get HIV from a dirty needle, that you're not going to, get robbed, or that you're not going to, you know, overdose and die, or you're not going to get arrested and end up in jail or prison.
And yet I think so many of us believe, particularly I think maybe for folks who don't have experiences of regularly visiting our loved ones, we think that it's about rules, and that these are highly governed places, and that part of the experience you write about is understanding how capricious it is.
Yeah, totally. Prison, well, and jail too, is so much like its own kingdom in that, you know, even if there's rules or if there's policies or, you know, if there's a state commission that has some say in how these places are run, in the moment, none of that matters. Like, it is a kingdom behind cinder block and barbed wire, and sort of anything can happen there.
One of the things that happened to you was time in solitary confinement. And as much as you just read to us about the sound, can you tell us a bit about what you experienced in solitary?
You know, I think a lot of people have told me over the years since I've gotten out and, you know, I've been talking about this. People say, oh, I like spending time alone. I wouldn't mind solitary that much, you know, but solitary is not spending time alone. Solitary is more like being buried alive. You're in a room that's like, I don't know, the size of maybe a large bathroom. In my case, there were sort of neon white walls almost, you know, there's no clock. You have no sense of time. The only voices you're hearing are sort of muffled echoes through, you know, shouting through the vents or the toilet, you know, or whatever noise comes in under your door. I mean, I think one of the things about solitary is that it so fundamentally eats away at two of the really key things about what it means to be human, right? One of the ways that we see ourselves as human is in relation to other people, like how we relate to other people, you know, self versus other. And solitary cuts that off. You don't have that contact with other people anymore. And it also, you know, it takes away so much of your agency and ability to make decisions and do things. And you lose that sense of like self in relation to other or ability to relate to others. And you also lose this so much of your ability to have any agency. And I think it's really disorienting to be in this situation that so fundamentally undermines what it means to be human.
What does it mean to be human? And obviously that's too big a question to fully answer, but I'm interested in the various answers that you may have found and refound and lost in the context of this experience.
I mean, I think that one of the most powerful things about being human that stuck with me through prison is just the ability to be in community with other people, like other humans, you know. Some of the moments that really stand out to me when I was locked up are these rare moments of sort of communal joy, which do happen in prison. And it's not every day. It's not all the time. And, you know, it feels like you're sort of stealing this moment of happiness from a place that is sort of meant to prevent it. But there would be moments, like there was one time I hadn't been in very long and I was in the gym. I was very new to prison. I'd just gone from county jail to state prison and I was very new and I was in the gym and I was there with another girl who was also new and we were on like the stair steppers, I think. And, you know, we're just stepping away and there's music playing in the background. And then like Kelly Clarkson, "Since You've Been Gone" comes on. Guess you never felt that way, but since you've been gone. And it was so wild, but like, it was like a flash mob almost. I mean, not dancing, but just singing. Like everybody started singing. And you've got these sort of like tough women that have like done a lot of time, like, you know, over by the weight piles and stuff. And everybody was like singing this. And I looked at the girl next to me like, am I really seeing this? This is so wild. Like Prison the Musical. Like it was just this moment of everybody singing along. And that sort of community, that sort of ability to relate to other people and, you know, exist in community with other people, I think is one of the sort of most enduring things about being human that you reach for even in prison.
After Carrie spent 2 years incarcerated in New York State, she finished her degree at Cornell University and became a reporter focused on prisons and jails. Now, the narrative of this memoir takes place over a number of years, but it isn't linear. It flips between Carrie's memories of being intoxicated and being incarcerated. I asked her why she chose this structure.
When you get arrested, I think you end up spending a lot of time sort of playing back your life before, you know, how I got here and just even just sort of remembering and yearning for the free world. So like the early days in jail are to some extent like you're living your life and then you're spending all this time remembering, like you're having these flashbacks, just like the flashback chapters. And also, I think time felt, you know, very much nonlinear at that point. You know, I was just coming off of drugs and I was in this very confusing, disorienting place. And this was after 9 years of having been on drugs. Everything felt nonlinear at that point.
Carrie writes about how her addictions and drug use were forms of self-harm. And I couldn't help but think how striking it is that we use prison as punishment for self-harm.
I've never thought of it in that framing, but I mean, yeah, you're so right. I think that actually does a much better job of explaining what people get at when they talk about trauma-informed care in jail or prisons, or when they talk about the need for gender-responsive facilities that are that pay more attention to like women's needs and specific traumas, because I think the sort of self-harm behaviors that you're describing would describe an even higher percentage of female prisoners than male. And, you know, yet prisons are structures that are traditionally built with men in mind in so many ways. And they, you know, they do badly for men, obviously, but they do even less, I think, to deal with women's specific needs, whether it's just sort of basic healthcare needs or, you know, past sexual trauma.
I'm wondering about the opportunity of those who are currently doing time to read your book, whether or not it's available to folks.
Yeah, so this is a great question. I really wanted to make sure that my book would get to people in prison. Like, that was really important to me in putting this out. So we actually started a thing where you can order a book online and it will be set aside for to be sent to someone in prison. And I've been, you know, for the past several months collecting a list of people in prison who wanted copies. So I think we've gotten about 500 copies funded that way. So I've been working on that. So far, prisons have been letting it in. There is one that there was a little confusion and there was some holdup and they said it was banned. And then they said, oops, no, it's not. And they let the girl have it. So, yeah, it's gotten in New York, shockingly. I didn't think they'd let it in because, I mean, that's like part of it takes place there, you know? And then it's gotten in Texas and the BOP. However, it's in hardback right now. So many prisons don't allow hardback. So I am currently only able to send it into the states that allow hardback. When it comes out in softback, then, you know, there's a whole other set of prisons that consider whether they're going to ban it then or not.
During the years, I hosted a television show and often, you know, would have guests who were themselves formerly incarcerated folks. Almost always, the flood of letters would come, the letters from incarcerated folk. I am assuming you must get a lot of those letters.
I have so many. I have boxes. At one point, like the entire backseat of my car was filled with them. I mean, I'm staring at a pile right now. Yes, I get so many. And a lot of them are things that it's like, okay, maybe I earmark this because I'll write about it later. And I, you know, note the topic on the front and I have a whole filing system and I, you know, stash it away. Some of them are just, you know, thank yous. I get some really beautiful, kind thank you cards from people who are doing time and thank me for paying attention to them and, you know, giving them a voice. And I get some really beautiful prison artwork too. At one point when I was on Fresh Air one time and it was a little bit before Christmas and I mentioned that I'd gotten some Christmas cards. Like I think I said I'd gotten like one Christmas card already and people heard it. And I got this flood of Christmas cards that year from like all of these incarcerated people who heard that and were like, oh, you want more? We'll give you so many more. So my desk that year was just covered with these amazing hand-drawn cards and like cartoons of me. Somebody drew a little cartoon of me when I'd been in prison and my prison nickname was Harry Potter. So they drew a little like cartoon of me as Harry Potter.
Why in the world was your nickname Harry Potter?
I guess people thought I looked like Daniel Radcliffe. And I don't know. I guess I was like pretty nerdy, you know, reading and doing crosswords. And also I had glasses that they weren't round, but they were like vaguely Harry Potter-ish. And I had like short hair. So I think between the reading and the glasses and the short hair, that was enough.
There are so many good parts of that. You just said something too, just now, people doing time. Talk to me about that phrase, doing time.
I didn't realize how weird time is around jail and prison until I wrote it and realized how many times my descriptions of time come up in this book. But I did know, like, the thing I thought about a lot when I was in and then a lot more right when I got out was just the fact that when you're locked up, like the only goal that matters every day, really, at the end of the day, is that time passed. You know, you might have other things you needed to accomplish, like you have school, you have other things you're trying to get done. But like in the end, if you have an out date, if you have a possibility of getting out, then the only like really, really important goal at the end of the day is that time has passed. And if you succeed in that, if you succeed in just letting time pass, like you've won, you've done the most important thing you needed to for the day. And I didn't realize like how much that had sort of been a guiding principle that we don't even think about until I got out. And I was like, wow, I've just spent the past 2 years where the really most important thing I needed to accomplish every day was to just let time pass. And then sort of shifting back to life where you're having goals other than just like letting time pass and your metric for success is going to be something bigger than just time has passed. And that was a really... That was a transition that I wasn't even expecting to have to think about. It didn't occur to me that this was a shift that I had made and that I was going to have to unmake.
How do we correct corrections?
This is such an unpopular answer, but the reality is if, you know, we're treating people behind bars in inhumane ways, you know, they're getting sort of unidentifiable food, inadequate medical care, there's not enough staff to let them out for showers. Some of that does involve spending more money. It'd be great to have fewer people to need to spend this money on. But, you know, in some places, that's not the immediate reality. You know, I live in Texas. We have 25,000 fewer people in prison now than we did before the pandemic. That is a huge and unprecedented population decrease. But that still leaves us with around 120,000 people in prison. And if they're going to be in an environment that is sort of not as dehumanizing as it is now, like that's going to cost more money. And I that's not an answer that either side likes to hear. You know, you don't want to spend more money on prisons, but then, you know, progressives don't want to invest more money in prisons either. And I mean, I get both of those sets of reasoning, but like the reality is that just to minimize the harms to people that are there now, and people that aren't immediately going to be released, like that does require some investment, you know, in those people. It doesn't have to be in the prisons, but in the people who are in the prisons.
Carrie Blakinger, a reporter for the Marshall Project and author of the memoir, Corrections in Ink. Thank you for sharing with us, Carrie.
Thank you for having me.